Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. Episode 46, we continue the theme of space biology. This time we turn our attention to human medicine. What are the effects of lunar spaceflight on cardiovascular health? Michael Delf is with the Department of Nutrition, Food and Exercise Sciences at Florida State University. Here are his thoughts as expressed in January of 2021.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak with you about this important topic. So the cardiovascular system is complex, and generally most people, when they think about that, they think about arteries, capillaries, and veins, but it really is integrated with those three parts of the circulation that also includes the lymphatic vessels. And the arteries, lymphatics, veins are lined with endothelial cells, and of course capillaries consist exclusively of endothelial cells. And these cell types and the endothelial cells in them really play some very profound functions within the cardiovascular system. So they control vascular relaxation, constriction, and correspondingly fluid flow through these vessels. They control platelet adhesion and aggregation. They balance blood coagulation and fibrinolysis. And of course, both of these things are important not only for blood clotting, but for long-term plaque accumulation and ultimately the development of atherosclerosis. They also play a role in regulating immune responses and inflammation. They're important regulators of vascular growth and structural remodeling of vessels, and then they provide a barrier function such as the blood-brain barrier, a blood-retinal barrier. So there are a number of clinical issues associated with spaceflight in the cardiovascular system, for example, orthostatic intolerance. There's long been speculation that spaceflight itself may be part of the initiation or acceleration of cardiovascular disease. But some of the large problems that have occurred in astronauts in spaceflight include the spaceflight-associated neuroocular syndrome, which is largely referred to as SANS, which involves a vascular component to that and ultimately results in a visual impairment. And more recently, there's been a report of venous blood flow stasis and thrombosis in the jugular vein of astronauts. And then the inclusion of radiation and going particularly to a lunar environment and how that might increase damage to endothelial cells that might ultimately elevate the risk of cardiovascular disease. So if you look at the effects of spaceflight with low Earth orbit during a short period of time, so less than 48 hours, then you have several things that happen in the short term, but really short-term spaceflight does not result in any really major long-term effects. But the longer that you stay in spaceflight and low Earth orbit, there do become, in the short term, some maladies that occur. For example, cardiovascular deconditioning, SANS, venous thrombosis. But there are also some long-term effects, which do include SANS. But then if you go beyond low Earth orbit, so to the moon for 1 to 2 weeks, again, cardiovascular deconditioning, volume shifts, SANS, and radiation-induced changes. And then long-term risks are radiation-induced changes and SANS. Of course, these are not shown, but that's speculated to occur. And then even longer duration mission into deep space, again, cardiovascular deconditioning, SANS, altered immunity, and then long-term consequences would be SANS. So there are a number of disease states or health problems that are related to the cardiovascular system that can occur not only in microgravity low Earth orbit, but potentially be made worse during a lunar mission. So just to quickly describe SANS to you, what is thought about that may be involved in SANS is that during spaceflight, there's a headward fluid shift, and that fluid pressures and the regulation of pressure and flow within the brain may be altered. And of course, the arteries, veins, lymphatics are involved in the regulation of the fluid flows and pressure. And then that these pressures may be transmitted to the eye. And also many of the same fluid flow, fluid pressure problems in regulating those may happen with SANS. So again, with increase in intracranial pressure or some of the others, there are a number of changes that occur within the eye that I won't go through here, but all of which can affect both short-term and long-term vision. Arterial vessels, blood-brain barrier integrity, venous vessels, as well as lymphatic vessels, all have some form of endothelial dysfunction associated with them. Now, we have not studied the eye, but the eye is very similar. So really, just to go over this new paper, and it's a new problem of jugular blood flow stasis and thrombosis, but I just want to say that one of the things that happens that can lead to this thrombosis in the jugular vein is, in fact, endothelial dysfunction. And there are a number of factors that can affect endothelial function in a vein, and that includes altered shear stress, pressures within the vein, immune dysfunction, decompression stress, dysoxia, hyperthermia. Older individuals may be more susceptible to dysfunction, chronic psychological stress, sleep problems, and altered circadian rhythm. So all of these things are part of spaceflight. And then a lunar mission would actually increase and really change the nature of the radiation exposure. So as we go from low Earth orbit to the moon, the deep space radiation becomes an even greater concern. And so this is really what we've been interested in, is looking at the effects of weightlessness as well as radiation on the vasculature and endothelium. One of the things that is of concern is health risk. And so one of the ways of looking at radiation, its relation to elevated risk of cardiovascular disease, is looking at, for example, the Japanese atomic bomb survivors. And it really is a relatively low dose of radiation exposure that elevates risk. And the same occurs with occupational and environmental exposure. And so it's hypothesized that even short-term radiation exposure in deep space could elevate cardiovascular risk. And so this is just a series of studies where we looked at unloading to simulate microgravity, space radiation, and their combined effects. So if you look at simulated weightlessness, the early effects, it does induce endothelial dysfunction, increase oxidative stress. Radiation by itself does the same thing, although through different pathways, and the combined provides an additive effect. But if you look at the late effects, for example, the equivalent of 20 human years, it really is only the radiation that has a prolonged effect on the vascular endothelium. And these have different effects on different parts of the circulation. So in conclusion, spaceflight in low Earth orbit induces various adaptations in arteries, capillaries, venous, and lymphatic vessels. In most instances, it involves dysfunction of vascular endothelial cells. The impairment of the endothelial cells during long-duration spaceflight could underlie or contribute to problems in the development of SANS, disruption of blood-brain barrier, blood-retinal barrier function, venous thrombosis, and elevated risk for cardiovascular disease. Endothelial cells are particularly sensitive to radiation exposure, and deep radiation environment of lunar exploration could exacerbate the cardiovascular maladies known to occur in low Earth orbit. And the ground-based simulations of weightlessness and deep space radiation, as well as endothelial cell culture, are by themselves inadequate for our understanding of the effects of the lunar space flight on cardiovascular system. So thank you for your attention.
Michael Delf of Florida State University. NASA has been studying humans and space since its inception in 1958. If you think the study would by now be complete, you would be wrong. Stephen Platts is involved in the ongoing human research program at NASA.
So here's the human research program mission. So our mission is to enable space exploration beyond low Earth orbit by reducing the risks to human health and performance through a focused program of basic, applied, and operational research. What we'll be talking about today is largely applied and operational research. Basic research is done mostly here on the ground and a little bit on space station. And then all of this leads to the development of human health, performance, and habitability standards, things like radiation exposure limits, CO2 limits, exercise prescriptions, nutritional standards, things like that. We also develop countermeasures and other risk mitigation solutions like compression garments, LBNP potentially for future missions, and pharmaceutical interventions potentially for things like space motion sickness or for bone loss. And then finally, we deliver advanced habitability and medical support technologies, and a number of these technologies are in development right now. We take a phased approach to almost everything, and the phasing can be different depending on what specifically we're talking about. But if we're talking about how we're going to get to the moon and Mars, we're absolutely taking a phased approach. So the first phase for us is the work we do here on Earth. So we have ground-based analogs to look at the various stressors of the spaceflight environment. We have a bed rest facility that we utilize in Cologne, Germany called NVHAB. And there we do bed rest, and that simulates the microgravity aspect of spaceflight. We do isolation in a number of different facilities, Antarctica, NEK, which is in Moscow, and then the HERA, which is at Johnson Space Center, and that's our short duration isolation. And isolation can be used to represent any mission in a smaller vehicle or in a smaller habitat. And then we also have a space radiation laboratory at Brookhaven National Labs. And that's where we do our galactic cosmic radiation simulations. We do a lot of work in low Earth orbit, utilizing the station as an analog for lunar missions or missions to Mars. It's a unique test bed. We have microgravity and a number of different hazards. I'll discuss hazards in just a second. It's a great base for us to get a lot of information. And then finally, the lunar missions. Decreasing Earth dependence around and on the lunar surface, that is going to go a long way to helping us for Mars missions. It'll provide insight into deep space radiation, something that we can't simulate really in a human here on Earth or even in low Earth orbit. Behavioral health, the further away from Earth you get, the more stress that the individual sees. And then those gravity transitions. We haven't been able to replicate the gravity transitions since Apollo. It's unique. It's going to be incredibly important for our long-term missions. And so I mentioned hazards. So, we are part of NASA, so we have to give an acronym to everything. So we've identified five hazards to the human in spaceflight. And so we call it RIDGE. So the R stands for radiation. I is for isolation and confinement. D is distance from Earth. G is gravitational fields or the lack thereof. And E is environments. And you can see where each one of these poses a unique stressor to the human body. But spaceflight gives us all of these put together. And much of the research that's been done in the past is done on one or maybe two of these hazards. Very, very little has been done on the entire holistic group of hazards that the humans sees. And being able to do research on the station, being able to do research on Artemis and on the lunar surface is really going to help us to make Mars a success. If you look at research opportunities here on Earth, we have lots of different facilities. We have essentially unlimited human capital that we can tap into, large laboratories, all the equipment we could need. But if we look at mission constraints, we don't have any, but we also don't have a realistic spaceflight environment. And as we progress through low Earth orbit, through lunar and to Mars, you can see that we have a change in the research opportunity. So we have less time available to do research, fewer resources, and mission constraints go up. You know, again, time, resources, and we have to be able to maximize that. So the research that we're proposing for the future takes all of that into account and tries to maximize as much as we can.
NASA's Stephen Platts wants to continue his research on the Artemis Humans to the Moon project.
So why do human research on Artemis? To us, it's a no-brainer, but you know, it might not be obvious that this mission represents a truly unique opportunity to gather data to characterize the effects of deep space and operational environments on astronauts. And we haven't had that since Apollo. And even on Apollo, that was relatively limited. So the opportunity to study the radiation and the microgravity transition to lunar gravity, and then transition back to microgravity, and then transition back to 1G. How is that going to affect the human body? Right? We can postulate all we want. The answer is we really don't know what that's going to look like. This unprecedented mission will have both females and males living and working together. Again, we have opportunity to see that on the space station, but we have not had that opportunity in other venues. And the opportunity to study females has been quite a bit limited. So we're looking forward to having a more equal distribution of men and women participating in these missions. And then finally, I mean, the scenario to understand how the human adapts to all of those hazards that I mentioned of spaceflight and then maintain a high level of mission performance in a very constrained environment, right? That's a lot to do. And so, again, these missions are going to make this possible. And it's something that we just can't do anywhere else. We can't do it here on Earth. We can't do some of it even on station. Not until we get to the lunar environment are we really going to be able to study a lot of these things and how they interact with each other. And so our mission philosophy for Artemis, unobtrusively and non-invasively, we're going to quantify all of the training, the risk management, the workload, the countermeasures, all of that together to try and understand how all of these lead to a successful mission. We will be proposing low mass, low volume, things like wearables, other technologies that will allow us to look at as much as we can in the human system without having a big impact on time. We will have an in-depth characterization of the individuals. And this is a mind shift that has gone on in the last, I don't know, 5 or 10 years on how medicine is practiced. And so, you know, we're not just talking about medicine of populations, we're talking about medicine of individuals. And this has not been available, and it's newly coming into practice. And we can develop countermeasures for individuals. We can look at the metadata for specific vehicles, and we have a lot more information and a different way of looking at it. Computing power has progressed so much, even in the last few years, that we can do analyses almost real time that used to take us days or weeks to do. And finally, it's important to mention this applied research approach that we're taking. And we are quite an applied research program, but we're very risk focused. What are the major risks we need to deal with? What are the things in the human that are most important? Where are the weaknesses? Where are the strengths? How are we going to maximize this human system in a mission? And the Artemis missions will enable this Moon to Mars benefit for the Sustainable Lunar Campaign.
In April of 2021, Stephen Platts further explained the medical goals and objectives of the Artemis Moon project and indicated he has aspirations towards sending humans to Mars.
Our goal is to advance the knowledge to support safe, productive human space travel and perform systems testing to reduce risks for future human exploration. Again, our applied approach, we are looking at a very risk-based focus. And then we have five objectives. The first, exploration medical operations advancement, to evaluate and validate Earth-independent crew health and performance systems and operation. This is very important for that Moon to Mars aspect of it. When we have a 20-plus minute comm delay and we're going to have a significant autonomy, we need to test that. We need to figure that out well beforehand, and that's part of our objectives. The integrated human system research, I've mentioned this a few times, evaluate the changes to the human system and validate countermeasures, right? So we have countermeasures that we validated for shuttle and for low Earth orbit. Are those still going to apply on the lunar surface? You know, we can, again, hypothesize that they will, but the answer is we really won't know until we look at them. The living environment. So a lot of people don't realize how living your environment really is. Evaluate the interactions of the habitation system and all of the spaceflight hazards and validate crew health and performance. And so the microbiome is something that we've talked about quite a bit as scientists, and lots of people realize that the microbiome is inside our gut, right? And so we eat yogurt and we have all of these other drinks and pills and everything to sustain our microbiome. But our microbiome extends well beyond that, right? It's on the surface of our skin. It's in our hair. It's on our eyes. And it's on our environment. It's the walls of the station, the walls of any of our vehicles will have living organisms. And we need to evaluate that as much as anything else. Special task-related issues. So evaluate and validate operational implementation of critical tasks and human factors for adequate crew health and performance. And then finally, extended mission durations. For us, again, this is our Moon to Mars. Test crew health and performance with the hazard environments, mission durations, and systems representative of Mars class missions. This has been on our radar for a long time, and it's one of our main focus points is to get that level of fidelity so that we can really look at what we think is going to happen on a Mars mission.
NASA's Stephen Platts has specific proposals for medical payloads on the Artemis missions.
And so here are the nine payloads that we've identified for early Artemis. Ultrasound, and this one will be critical for us. Many of our most important risks can be evaluated using ultrasound. So even though it's one payload, it's actually many potential experiments and very critical. The newer machines are handheld machines. Crew and team performance measures, these are largely surveys and things like that. Spaceflight standard measures, which will be a subset, a lot of pre and post flight, and then potentially some in-flight work as well. Dry saliva sampling booklets. So these are dry little booklets where you just wet it in your mouth, and then you'd be shocked at how many analytes and how many biomarkers we can look at that relate to stress and other markers in the human just from that. The crew health data management system, a heart rate monitor, again, something like this wearable. Lunar ascent, descent, dynamic loads, injury assessment, again, a survey, computer type work. Alterations of multisensory integration due to combined hazards. And then finally, blood analysis. And what we're looking at right now is dried blood spot analysis.
Stephen Platts of NASA's Human Research Program. Lunar dust will be a major hazard faced by astronauts on the moon. Not only are the particles of lunar regolith tiny and sharp-edged, they may be chemically reactive when exposed to biological materials. For more about this, we go to the Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California, where John Rask is researching the topic of chemical reactivity of lunar regolith.
Presentation that I'm going to give today is a collection of a variety of research efforts that include a number of folks at NASA Ames, JSC, NIOSH, and other academic organizations across the United States. And I would like to emphasize that chemical reactivity is going to be something that we need to really be considering as it relates to space biology, astrobiology, and planetary protection, as well as even human research aspects. And I will emphasize these in today's presentation. And what we knew over the last, 10 years or so has evolved as it relates to new information that's been coming in from the planetary science community. Very quickly, the composition of lunar material is made up of largely oxides, mainly silica glass. And it is silica and iron that give rise to chemically reactive components that are biologically reactive. And for this presentation, I'm going to focus in largely on the iron. Biology in the spaceflight environment is affected by reduced gravity and altered radiation. And the same thing is true for lunar material. Full spectrum UV, solar winds, protons from galactic cosmic rays, and impact processes themselves impart chemical reactivity to lunar material. And we're particularly interested in the finest fraction, that is 20 microns or so and smaller. And we know that transient increases in chemical reactivity and physical processes of mineral specimens have been shown to affect pulmonary toxicity. And we predict this to also be true in lunar dust and lunar regolith. So what does chemical reactivity mean? In what we're going to refer to it as those radicals that exist on mineral grains that can interact with oxygen and water. That is, reactive oxygen species, including hydroxyl radical, superoxide, and peroxide. And biological exposure to mineral grains and its chemical reactivity will elicit an inflammatory response that leads to cellular production of reactive oxygen species. So lunar dust and lunar materials can be chemically activated and increase the reactivity through solar wind particle events, UV and micrometeor impacts. But heating and the presence of water and oxygen can passivate that. And we know from studies that over the period of a number of hours, highly chemically reactive lunar dust will passivate into a less reactive state. We have samples and data from 9 different field sites that have contributed to this body of knowledge. And it's not just Apollo missions, it's also Russian missions, including the Luna robotic sample return missions. Of course, China now has brought back samples. So what evidence suggests lunar dust is actually chemically reactive? Early studies were done on specimens that looked at biological effects, radiation, and dissolution studies when samples first came back. And although those studies were very limited in their scope and sensitivity, they saw immediately that biological specimens did respond to the presence of lunar dust in their systems, as well as when exposed to radiation. Dissolution studies showed that most of the lunar material is inert, but that there is some amount that can become soluble. But more importantly, recent studies in the last 10 years have shown that freshly crushed lunar dust, that is pulverized or ground, like in a mortar and pestle, is much more reactive than it is in its non-crushed, passivated state. And this is similar to silica dust, and we predicted that this is similar to biological effects of highly chemically reactive silica dust in the form of silicosis. But most dramatically, visual representation also shows that the moon is rusted. Hematite is observed on the moon, and it's important to note that hematite itself in nanoparticle sizes are also toxic to bacteria. And these are 2 new research papers that have just come out of the last few months. So here's just a visual representation of hematite on the moon. Notice it's not everywhere. It's in the bright yellow and red regions. It's very localized to very specific areas, which tells us that water and oxygen is reacting with iron to form this mineral or this chemical. And so it's not everywhere, it's in very specific locations. And this has implications for where you want to land or where you don't want to land. The point is that this is an example of material on the moon that is reacted with oxygen and water. And we don't see it everywhere, it's only in very specific locations. We predict that it is this nanophase iron that is in the glassy rims of every single particle of lunar material that is reacting with oxygen and water to form the rust. And the little tiny dots that you see are these iron elemental iron grains that are produced during micrometeorite impacts. The elemental iron actually bleds to the surface during these high temperature heating impact processes. And it is these iron metals that we believe are contributing to the reactivity and potential biotoxicity that we'll talk about in just a moment. This is an example of how all of these mineral dust grains are actually attracted by a magnet. Larry Taylor was one of these individuals who carried around a container of lunar dust in his pocket when he went to meetings, and he would hold a magnet over that sample of dust, and you could actually physically see every piece of lunar dust become attracted to the magnet. Very dramatic representation of the presence of nanophase iron. So as the regolith of the moon becomes increasingly hardened and goes through these impact processes, the iron that is present in the material is converted into the nanophase iron. And so those regions of the moon that are considered mare, which are more basalt rich, as compared to highland, which are depleted in those iron rich minerals, there's a difference in the chemical reactivity between those two regions on the moon. Colleagues at JSC used hydroxyl radical scavenging assays to measure presence of hydroxyl radicals and has shown that mature samples, that is, samples that contain more nanophase iron, are much more chemically reactive than their immature counterparts. And so the point is that lunar soils at the surface become more mature over time due to space weathering, but buried regolith ages, but it does not mature. So it is important to point that maturity, that is the presence of nanophase iron, is directly linked to its reactivity as it relates to hydroxyl radical formation in the presence of water. The reactivity analysis of lunar samples and stimulants is something that's been going on over many, many years. But it's important to point out that as we look broadly across all of them, it's been measured on samples from both Apollo and Luna specimens. And both NASA and Russia have independently observed that Mare samples contain more nanophase iron than highland samples, that Mare samples are much more reactive than highland samples. And it's important to point out that biotoxicity studies in rodents have been conducted by both NASA and Russia. And Russia has done it on both highland and Mare samples and have pointed out in their studies that Mare samples appear to be more biotoxic than highland samples. And NASA, we worked on some Apollo 14 specimens, which is a highland sample, also measured that toxicity. Now, the Russian studies were much more limited because of the doses that they used were so high, but it still points to trends that exist as it relates to chemical reactivity and toxicity. And we predict that dust is going to be more reactive and enhanced in the lunar environment. The way we've measured it is just simply measure biological response as a function of dose. What we see is that three different preparations of Apollo 14 lunar dust that was instilled in the lungs of rats elicited a biological response. It was less toxic than quartz, but more toxic than titanium. But the highest chemically reactive version of the material that we produced elicited the most highly significant increased inflammatory response in the lung of rats. The particle size was similar, but again, the reactivity of all these specimens was varied. And the point is that the most chemically reactive version of the lunar dust we studied elicited the greatest biological response in the lungs of rats. So to just simply wrap up, in situ chemical reactivity is going to be something critical to space biology, astrobiology, as well as planetary protection and human research, because radicals contribute to cell death. They contribute to cell transduction disruption, gene expression changes, oxidative damage to nucleic acid proteins and lipids, and radicals react rapidly with organic molecules. They interfere with assays and other methods and can potentially damage instrumentation. So Earth-based analog simulants and archived lunar dust, we predict and assume, do not represent the full picture of in situ reactivity and biological effects. And so we would love to measure this in situ. And to prepare for that, all the engineering tests that need to be done must be conducted on appropriately treated specimens. And I thank the organizers for this time.
That was John Rask of the Ames Research Center.